Welcome to the Radio 191 FM podcast.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata, this is R1 News here on Radio 1. Ko Quintana ho, and I'll be taking you through the news here on Rahina Ruatako Mātoru or Haratua. Coming up on the show, I tēnei rā, we have Lily with the bulletin and weather. Following this, we'll be speaking to Green Party MP Ricardo Mendez-March about the changes to immigration policy as the borders reopen, and then we'll be speaking to Sean Prenter from the Disabled Students Association about the recently announced Ministry for Disabled Peoples in this year's budget. Then, towards the end of the show, we'll be interviewing the Green Party's candidate for the Otago Regional Council, Alan Somerville, about his candidacy. And to wrap up the show, we will be speaking to Lotto Ramsey from Critic Te Arohi about the menstruation issue of Critic this week. Also, a quick reminder that voting in the OUSA referendum opens today for you to have your say about the direction of your student executive. But right now, here is Lily with the bulletin and weather.
The Radio 191 FM news headlines.
Kia ora koutou, ko Lily Aho. Anthony Albanese and the Labour Party have emerged victorious over Scott Morrison in the Australian federal election. However, analysts say it is not yet clear whether the Labour Party has an outright majority. One of the biggest alterations to the Australian political landscape is the success of 10 independents, all women. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said she spoke to Albanese this morning, saying to NZ Herald, "Anthony and I have had the chance to meet before and I have no doubt that we'll have a strong working relationship that will serve both countries well." She also said Australia was New Zealand's most important partner. PM Jacinda Ardern says trade and Ukraine war on the agenda for possible meeting with US President Joe Biden as she leaves on a trade mission to the States tonight. While her trip to the White House hasn't been confirmed yet due to COVID clearance protocols, the PM says a call for the US to join the economic architecture of our region, referring to the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, is on the cards. Ardern said to RNZ this morning, CPTPP, that really important trade agreement, which has meant we've reduced tariffs and seen greater entry for our products into markets like Japan, is still the agreement we want with the United States to be a part of. But to see them answer that call with the Indo-Pacific economic framework is really important. The second thing she hopes to discuss will be the war in Ukraine. Teachers say they're running out of paid sick leave as a group of health experts from the University of Otago urge the government to develop a COVID-19 action plan for schools. An article from the group on the University of Otago Public Health Expert blog says the government needs to take more precautions against the virus during winter. They also want to push for higher vaccination rates among teachers and students, isolation for all close contacts of positive cases, and a commitment to closing schools if case numbers reach certain heights. The Primary School Teachers Union said in order to complete these proposed isolation requirements, teachers would need more sick leave. Secondary Principals Association head Vaughan Coolian echoed the statement, saying schools were struggling to cope with high numbers of staff away, with 20 staff from his own school being absent this past Friday from illness. Many of Dunedin's commuter bus services have been cancelled due to the driver illness this morning. The affected bus routes have been posted on the Otago Regional Council website, and they are urging people to check if its notifications page before travelling. Last Friday, over 50 alerts were sent out notifying the public of cancelled services across Dunedin. Operations are working to maintain as many bus services as possible, but more will have to see cancellations due to the challenging circumstances. And now, the weather.
The Radio 1 91 FM weather.
It is currently 10 degrees in Dunedin today, heading up to a high of 12 and falling to a low of 6 tonight with strong winds. Tomorrow it is set to be the exact same high and low with cold winds, however, slightly sunnier.
That was Lily with the bulletin and weather. Coming up on the show, we'll be speaking to Green MP Ricardo Mendez-March about immigration policy, and then after that, the Otago Disabled Students Association about the recently announced Ministry for Disabled Peoples. Right now, here is Spoonicorn with Ride the Rainbow on R1 News.
Variety. colour is the true god.
That was Spoonicorn with Ride the Rainbow here on R1 News. Aotearoa New Zealand's borders are reopening to the rest of the world at the end of July, with international students, cruise ships and migrant workers returning to Aotearoa. The return of migrant workers and international students comes with subtle changes to immigration policy. These restrict the periods that they can work here post-study and restricting the areas in which people can work. For example, if an international student studies at below bachelor's degree level, they are restricted to working in the area of their study, and if they change employers, they can only work for less than the median wage. The new policies also see an introduction of a green list for jobs in high demand. These professions will give migrants an immediate pathway to residency to plug a critical skill shortage. We're joined on the phone now by Green MP Ricardo Mendez March to talk about these changes to immigration policy. Morena, Ricardo, it's great to have you on the show.
Morena, thank you for having me.
Ricardo, how do you feel about the border reopening to the rest of the world sooner than anticipated?
Yeah, I think the border reopening hasn't been equitable in the sense that the timeline has meant that we've kind of put forward tourists over split migrant families from what we call non-visa waiver countries. So, for example, Pacific Island nations, India, and other global south countries. So while we're happy that the new dates means the families will be able to be reunited, I think we could have done far more to ensure that we're prioritizing communities affected by the border closures as opposed to, I guess, driving economic incentives by trying to get tourists in.
And so what would that far more have looked like?
So I think what we should have done is recognize that we've had families who've been split, offshore migrants have been stuck, and through those visa categories that people are in, bring those forward. What we ended up doing instead is saying, if you're from, say, the UK, you can just come through one of the earlier stages. If you're a family member from somewhere like India that needs a visitor visa to come in here, you're going to wait ages later. And so I think I would have swapped those things around and prioritized families over tourism.
Excellent. And so what is your take on the announced employer accreditation requirements that are coming into effect next year?
So we're really happy that employers will need to become accredited. But unfortunately, as part of this program to clamp down on migrant exploitation, the government omitted changing one of the most important policy settings that is driving exploitation, and that is employer-bound visas. So the setting will mean that if you're a migrant worker and you're coming here to work and you're on one of those accredited employer visa, you can only work for one employer. And we've been told by unions, by migrant workers, by even some employers that those settings actually, all that it does, create a dynamic where by nature of your whole ability to stay in the country dependent on one employer, that employer knows that they can take advantage of you. And so, again, what we would have done instead is to look at other settings, such as, for example, having an open work visa where maybe you can switch freely between accredited employers, but not necessarily having your visa conditions tied to one single employer.
And on that similar vein, what is your take on the median wage threshold that's being introduced with this accredited employer work visa?
So the government has been trying to address issues on low wages, and our concern is that while the Greens really support measures to lift wages through things like fair pay agreements and other policy settings, the way that we've put visa, salary criteria to visas means that what we're prioritizing, particularly when it comes to the residency pathways, which requires you to have a job that pays twice the median wage, that we're effectively going to prioritize high-income earners, and the gender and ethnic wage gap will inevitably be reflected on the types of migrants that are able to get those high-paying jobs. And so we're going to entrench some inequities as a result of having quite inflexible salary criteria when it comes to pathways to residency.
And so on that front, what would a Green Party policy look like instead?
So I think the pathways to residency under the new scheme, I think, need to recognise other things beyond your salary. So we would have had a setting that recognises the time that you have been here, as well as the types of jobs that you're working in. So right now, if you don't match on one of the green lists or the types of jobs that you have to work here for 2 years, the only pathway to residency is earning twice the median wage, and we think that's not equitable. The government showed us that we can do things like recognize the sort of contributions that migrants have made when they've spent here a considerable amount of time, when they released the R21 visa, where they set a sort of settled criteria of having lived here for 3 years. And so we would have liked to have something like, mostly to recognize that, you know, we've got to show a bit of reciprocity. We're going to benefit from the labor of migrant workers, and we're going to reap the fruits of their labor. I think we have to also show some sort of reciprocity to those workers.
And moving on to international students now, do you think it is fair that students studying a qualification at below bachelor's level will only be eligible for post-work study rights if the qualification they're studying is on the green list?
So the way this is a government's attempt to clamp down on shoddy international students institutions that like kind of attract international students to offer a pathway into work without necessarily offering meaningful qualifications. And while we do welcome the move to improve the quality of services that are offered to international students, I don't think clamping down on work rights is necessarily the way to do it. Mm-hmm. I think we need far better criteria for those institutions to even be set up. And what we're particularly concerned around, the way that we've now created a visa system, particularly for students, is that previously if there was a family coming in here and somebody was coming to do study, their partner would be eligible to work, recognizing that if the student is, you know, focusing on studies, they may not be able to work full time and make a living for the family. But now what they've done is effectively clamped down on the working rights of partners coming in. And that actually, what it will create is potential financial hardship, as well as power dynamics for those families coming in here with the primary applicant on a student visa.
And moving on to those financial hardships for international students, the government has increased the cost of living funds required for international students for the first time in a decade. I think it's $20,000 they're required to demonstrate at a tertiary level. Is this reasonable? Does it make sense?
I mean, this is, again, the government sending a signal that we want people that already come here with substantive amount of money. And I think what it ignores in terms of the reality on the other side for migrants is that many of the migrants coming in here on a student visa, they end up taking huge loans from the bank or from their own family members in order to meet those cost of living requirements. And then, you know, when they finally come here, they may have to repay that loan. And because they can only work 20 hours a week, then that puts them again into a potential situation where they're working for cash in hand. So I think the government can do better to support migrant students beyond just setting barriers that require them to effectively have tens of thousands of dollars already with them, because we know that the students that come, many of them do come from disadvantaged backgrounds seeking a better life, and the way that they'll meet those cost of living requirements may end up becoming creative and putting them in hardship, as we've seen time and time again over the years when we've seen stories of international students facing hardship.
And so we're running out of time, but I'd like to ask you one final question, which is, what would that support for international students from the government look like?
So I think, especially right now with many factors being quite uncertain, I think we could be extending a lot of the support that we gave domestic students to international students. I think especially when I look at some of those PhD students who have been here for many, many years, who are actually doing full-time work effectively by nature of tutoring or even lecturing, we should be extending sort of hardship funds and other things as well to them, because if we want to retain those students who are coming here and getting up, you know, trained and upskilled, I think we should be offering just as much support as we do to domestic students, particularly if we recognize that we may want to retain those students in areas where we have shortages.
Thank you very much for coming on the show, Ricardo. It's been a pleasure.
Peter Clinton, thank you so much.
That was Green Party MP Ricardo Mendes-March talking about immigration policy here on R1 News. Coming up right now, we have Leaping Tiger with New Psyche on R1 News.
Get it still, getting mad at what I'm saying. Saw you at the party style, now I'm serving Patrick Swayze. Found Nirvana in me, teens for a smell like OT. You had me acting 16, about to turn 23. 2022, treading lightly, talk to me nicely. Brooklyn on my Spike Lee, talking about it's hotter than I'm over what it's gonna been. When you and I've had other plans and now you got another man. Now I'm on my own, I'm just trying to see who I wanna be. So I'm at the party swaying, now I'm chilling just for Coley. Past few months I'm feeling like a ghost in these Nikes. Why you trying to curve me? Dan, don't take it personally. Rose on the grave with my heart on my sleeve, new psyche. Yep. Happy birthday, babe. I ain't stressed either way. Got my life back in a brand new lust, I'm biking. Get the fuck out my way. Blasha Booyaka. Don't mean to take it, father. Sunscreen smell like peach and guava. The beach brain wash away the chip. Got a clean shoulder, now I'm looking down. On my re, on my re. Watanabe on my what? Surfing swag style like it's Beychella. Goofy shoot the curl, make me feel bitter. It's another thing to wish harm on a fella. Slimy thoughts should've known better. Nice move slow and the days roam quick. Grab the ice in my hand, watch it melt. Am I best to see thou in the arms of another? Had to tell myself, sit down, buster. Bounce the goo to a waveform, double edge closure, and it's finally over. Now I'm on my own, I'm just trying to see who I wanna be. So I'm on the gram sleigh, but I'm chilling just for Goalie. Past few months, I'ma feel like a ghost in these Nikes. Why you trying to curve me? Dan, don't take it personally. Rose from the grave with my heart on my sleeve, new psyche. Yep. Happy birthday, babe. I ain't stressed either way. Got my life back in a brand new lust, I'm biking. Give up what you heard, you a idiot.
It is 23 minutes past 11 and you are listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. Last Thursday was Budget Day, which saw the government announce its plans for its spending for 2022 and beyond. The government had three primary focuses for this year's budget: COVID-19 response, healthcare reform and tackling climate change. $11.1 billion were allocated for healthcare spending, with close to $1 billion put towards improving welfare for disabled peoples. This funding included establishing a Ministry for Disabled Peoples, which according to MSD will lead the disability system transformation work, operate as a ministry including providing policy and budget advice to the Ministry of Disability Issues, and manage relevant legislation. We're joined in the studio now by Sean Prenter, co-president of the Otago Disabled Students Association, to talk about this announcement. Morena, Sean, it's great to have you in the studio.
That's about it, Quinton. Thank you for having me.
Sean, how do you feel about the budget's announcement for the disabled community?
I think there's definitely a positive step with some concrete investment going into the Ministry for Disabilities. However, I think there's quite a lumping towards the ministry in of itself. So the ministry will be fantastic in terms of defragmenting the lack of disability inclusivity or target in the different ministries. However, it's missing that sort of like on the ground proactive policy to deal with disabled issues. And you can really see that in the COVID response, where there's been really poor accessibility for the different information that's been distributed to the disabled community.
So what would this on-the-ground response look like to you?
The on-the-ground response is largely looking at a living wage support, because the support there for disabled students and students more generally, with the hardship that students are dealing with inflation, just doesn't go far enough. And the Band-Aid, which is proposed in the budget, really just doesn't go far enough to sort of covering the war wound which inflation has left.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And so, looking at the Ministry for Disabled Peoples, just generally, what are your thoughts on it, and how do you think it should work?
I think it's fantastic in the sense that we're going to have a more centralised approach to more inclusive workplaces. I can see real potential there for the public sector to sort of lead the way for disability inclusion, and then trickling out to the private sector. And sort of, I guess, coming back to that idea of defragmentation, right? You know, the disabled community deal with a host of different inequities across the board, be it health, be it finance. And so having a ministry in the centre there to be able to coordinate a more just response, I think, would be fantastic. But I think with Labour, you see a lot in the way of the Zero Carbon Act, and it's that sort of like that slow change coming about there. Like, certainly in regards to the Zero Carbon Act, really important piece of legislation to be crafted, much as it is with building the Ministry for Disabilities. But we're missing those on the ground problems, and that is those issues with finance, which the current budget just doesn't address.
Do you think that once this ministry is established, we'll see more of this on the ground sort of thing, or do you think that's a separate issue?
I think it's a separate issue, and I think it's one which is quite divisive amongst the disabled community, in the sense that at the moment the steering group for the ministry is not led by a disabled person, and the disabled community or otherwise disability rights movement has really campaigned on Nothing About Us Without Us, and for some disabled people you know, that's a complete contradiction to what the rights movement stands for, and for others it's you know, it's the idea of helping non-disabled people be able to see through a disabled lens and working towards further integration. So I think it's the there's certainly not a consensus as of yet.
So on this front then, what are some policy changes that you'd like to see to help the disabled community?
I think a huge one is accessibility legislation, which is currently being pushed through. So yet to have reached a draft stage yet in central government, but the policy that's currently underpinning it fails the recommendations which were given by the Access Alliance. And that's also been supported by the ATHRA Law Foundation. And it doesn't have any ability to monitor or there being any consequences of discrimination in relation to accessibility, and that then makes any potential legislation which is going to eventuate toothless.
And so what further support would you like to see for the disabled community in the next budget and budgets to come?
I think there needs to be specific tailored support for disabled students, for the disabled community, and students more generally. You know, like you see with universities being under pressure with, you know, missing international students, for example, and there being cuts across the board there, and staff are struggling, students are struggling, and so there needs to be more tailored support there. And that tailored support would look like having a more livable wage for students, as opposed to what we currently have, which is that Band-Aid I mentioned. And actually, like, there's an insult to injury there, which I glossed over, and that's the fact that if you're on a winter energy plan, which many of the disabled community are, you're in fact not entitled to this further support as part of the bill. And, you know, it's is bizarre to assume that people that would be on that winter energy plan would be in such a situation where they, you know, they're not going through financial hardship as it is anyway. And, you know, Grant's response to that is that the previous bill had some targeted response, but of course that doesn't account for the high levels of inflation we have now.
And so, talking back about the disabled student community, this increased support, you've talked a lot about the national level. Is there things that the university could do to support them as well?
I think with the university, it's just a case of consultation and empowering those disabled disabled voices, which the university does a great job through the Disability Information and Support Service. And so, yeah, really a continued relationship there that embodies Manaakitanga, I think, is will lead the way to better outcomes for disabled students.
Thank you very much for joining us in the studio, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sean Printer from the Otago University Disabled Students Association talking about the new Ministry for Disabled Peoples. Right now on R1 News, we have Yumi Zuma with Mona Lisa, and following that, we'll have Billie Jean with Hick. You're listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. It is 22 minutes to 12, and if you have any questions, queries or comments throughout the show, you can always text in on 0212 Radio 1. That is 0212 272 3461. Last week, the Green Party announced its candidates for the 2022 local body elections. Mayor Aaron Hawkins will be standing again for re-election and is joined by current Green Party DCC Councillor Marie Laufiso as candidate for the Dunedin City Council. Councillor Laufiso told R1 News that they are the first of eight Dunedin-born Samoans with a Tongan maternal grandmother. The Laufiso family used to be a part of the family-based collective known as the Freedom Roadworks, who established a homeschooling collective and focused on Te Tiriti or Waitangi-based community development. Laufiso is running for a third term on the council with aims to progress the city's progressive development. Laufiso believes that this direction is about prioritising the three well-beings, social, environmental and cultural, rather than a sole focus on economic well-being. Laufiso is motivated to run by the fact that COVID-19 has exacerbated and worsened living conditions for low-income families. Laufiso's top three priorities for Dunedin are ensuring every child and young person knows that the city has their back, abolition of homelessness in the city, and an increase in diversity in key strategic leadership roles. Laufiso is a member of the Green Party because of their commitment to the Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and prior to being a Green Party member, they were a supporter of the Mana movement. Currently, the Green Party has no members sitting on the Otago Regional Council. In 2019, the Green Party ran candidate Scott Willis, who won over 10,000 votes, but was ultimately unsuccessful in being elected to council. This year, the party is running Alan Somerville, who joins us in the studio now. Alan was a prominent figure in the Play Centre movement and is a former early childhood educator. Mōrena, Alan, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Atamarie, thank you, Quinton.
So, Alan, can you tell me, why are you running for the Regional Council?
Well, when there are things that are important to you, that you think are important, it's important, too, to do something about them. And there's big issues around climate change, looking after the environment, action on social inequality. Now, I think those things are very important. And there's then various different paths you can take to take action on those things. And in my life at the moment, the Regional Council is a path that has opened up.
And so why the Green Party?
I think the Greens' values of ecological wisdom and social justice are very, very important and ring very true with me. And so that's why I've joined the Green Party. I could, of course, look at standing as an independent for this, but I've chosen the Green Party because I think that label makes it clear where I'm coming from. We know that turnout in local body elections is generally low, was about 45% last time in Dunedin. And a reason many people give for not voting is that they don't know anything about the candidates. Now, there's a whole lot of people in Dunedin who don't know me from a bar of soap, but by standing with the green label, that tells them a lot about what my priorities are.
And so how can your previous experience be applied to a position on the Regional Council?
Well, the council's chief role is around environmental planning and environmental management. Now, I'm not an environmental scientist, but that's not the role of the councillors. The role of the councillors is to be able to listen to people, to be able to establish good relationships, to open up good communication, to respect the role of mana whenua, and to be able to take on information in different ways. And I guess that I've had plenty of practice in those things. And I think that whole idea of finding common ground with people and being able to work out a way forward that everyone can work with, that's something that I've been doing, in my professional career for many, many years, and that's such an important part of being a councillor.
And so what changes would you like to see the Regional Council make?
Well, the Regional Council, if you've been following the news, has been in the news mostly for the wrong reasons lately. So on top, I would say, it's re-establishing good relationships amongst councillors and between councillors and staff. The conflict that's been going on, I think, has really hindered the work of many staff members. And so that needs to be put on a sound footing. And so, as I was saying, those skills of establishing good relationships and finding common ground are important there. That's one thing. I would also say that making really good long-term plans to look after and enhance our environment is really important. And that's about looking at the changes that are going to come with climate change and looking at appropriate land use. For example, we have in much of Otago, we have a dry climate, and yet we are trying to carry out farming that needs lots of water. As climate change comes in too, though, that may be even more of an issue. So making sure there is appropriate agricultural use for the land that's there. As a third one, a third priority, I would say, well, we've heard quite a bit about diversity on local councils lately, and I'm afraid I don't bring much to add to the diversity of the Otago Regional Council, but I will be pushing to change to STV, single transferable voting system, for future elections. And there's plenty of evidence to show that using the STV system brings greater diversity, and that greater diversity of representation brings better decisions.
And so, going back to your previous point about the internal politics of the regional council, I mean, we've seen plenty of articles about that, with Councillor Marion Hobbs being ousted out of the chairperson position and then eventually resigning from the council. And they've also been criticised for ineffective governance, at times. How do you think you would navigate this internal politics?
Yes, well, there's no doubt that's going to be a challenge, but I guess I'm up for that challenge. And I suppose I go back to those things about listening to people and establishing what the common ground is. Now, even though there have been those, you know, serious differences between councillors, the regional council last year did agree to its 10-year long-term plan. And so that does establish within that plan a number of really good progressive goals that the council has already agreed to. So I think it's working partly with this plan to say that this is the stuff that the council has agreed to. Actually, we have to work with this, and then looking for ways that we can make that work.
Thank you very much for joining us in the studio, Alan. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much. A pleasure here too.
That was Green candidate for the Otago Regional Council, Alan Somerville, talking about why he's running, why he's in the Green Party, and what he thinks the Regional Council needs to do. Coming up on R1 News right now, we have Kylie Price with Stay.
I know it's late. You call me up again, you say you're drunk. I can hear your friends in the background acting dumb. They know what's up, they've heard this song before. It's the same song you always seem to sing. And I'm the girl who can't help but listen in. We never change, we're hopeless. I don't usually say this out loud. I don't usually say this out loud. But sometimes I wonder. You only call me in the evening. You only call me when the daylight starts to fade, and you'll be long gone by the morning. But why don't you stay? I'd bring you breakfast in bed and blue Powerade to fix your head from your night before, 'cause God forbid that I was worth your Sunday morning sober. I don't usually say this out loud. I don't usually say this out loud. But sometimes I wonder. You only call me in the evening. You only call me when the daylight starts to fade, and you'll be long gone by the morning. But why don't you stay? Why? I'm always lonely in the morning.
call me in the evening. Yeah, you only call me when the daylight starts to fade, and you'll be long gone by the morning. But why don't you stay?
Was Elgis Harding with Fever here on R1 News on Radio 1. It is 8 minutes to 12, and as always, we are talking about Critic Te Arohi today. So the editor, Fox Mayer, is away this week in the land of the free, so I'm joined in studio by Lotto Ramsey to talk about the menstruation issue of Critic. Morena Lotto, it's great to have you in the studio on such short notice.
Hey, I'm happy to be here.
So you wrote kind of the prime feature in it this week about transmasculine periods, which was really interesting and a really well-written and just excellent read. Could you tell me a bit about this piece and your inspiration for it?
Well,
you know, there's a lot to cover in the menstruation-themed issue every year, and only so much gets in. And there were so many other features that I wanted to work on that are specifically about periods. But, you know, for me, the menstruation, transmasculine menstruation one, was just the most prominent. You know, I feel like you can't have a period issue without mentioning that people other than women get periods, for one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a personal one, too. Like, I've... I'm some flavor of non-binary. I get a little bit of dysphoria around periods, and that's hard enough for me to handle, let alone someone who identifies, you know, as a binary trans man or someone transmasculine non-binary, for one. And I notice that there aren't any resources and that I don't actually know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't, then I feel like your standard, you know, cis person would know even less.
Definitely. So on this front, then, what do you think could be done by the university or the government to kind of just make this space more accessible and more comfortable for people that are struggling in that realm?
I mean, you know, it's where to start, really, because there's a whole lot can be done. We did get a statement back from the university talking about their gender-neutral bathroom plan, which is a great start. But, you know, it's quite a long time coming.
Mm-hmm.
Focusing on signage for now, things like you know, there's the queer space just next door, basically, and it doesn't have any gender neutral bathrooms near it.
That yeah. seems a bit short-sighted.
Yeah. So I'd say, you know, within the university, you know, start with the queer space, make sure there are sanitary bins in the men's mm-hmm. bathroom near the queer space, and then just, I don't know, the thing is that there's really nothing being done currently. There's kind of an effort to, you know, change, like I mentioned in the article, signage at supermarkets from feminine hygiene products to saying period care or just, mm-hmm. you know, health and beauty.
Yeah.
But then when I went to New World yesterday and I looked, there's still a massive signs saying feminine hygiene.
Yeah, that's not really going to help at all,
yeah,
is it?
No.
And so you talked about there were other stories that you would have loved to write for the issue. What would they have been about?
So there's one that might still be in the works with our culture editor on kind of, you know, daily life with periods and hormone cycles too. Because,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, estrogen hormone cycles are quite a stigmatized thing, and then if you add in how they affect other conditions, like I've written about my ADHD at the start of the year on our prescription stimulants piece of the drugs issue, and, you know, a factor for me is how just apparently depending where I am in my cycle, it affects how well my meds work, which is just a fun little thing.
Yeah, something I've never heard talked about.
Yeah, exactly. Like, estrogen can affect a whole host of conditions. And again, you know, no one talks about this and you just assume that you're losing it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was there another piece in Critic this week, either written by you or anyone else this week, that really piqued your interest?
I loved Ruby's piece on, what to expect when you're not expecting. Brilliant title. the one on menopause.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's a really interesting one. You know, also not just because you can go into menopause, you know, when you're older, but some young people can go through menopause if you have, like, a hysterectomy for whatever reason, or I've even heard of it being done to medically managed, like PMDD, which shouldn't get brought up too much this issue, but it's still pretty relevant to young people, surprisingly.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the studio, Lotto. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lotto Ramsey, apologies, from Critic Te Arohi to talk about this week's issue, the menstruation issue. Right now, we have Brett McKenzie with a little tune to wrap up the R1 News. Ko Quinton Aho, and tune in next week again. Thank you very much.
Some things in life are priceless. For everything else, there's New Zealand On Air, proudly keeping the good ship Radio 1 afloat for another 25 years.
I'm about to go.
FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.